History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. In 2020, something that concerns people on both the political left and right is that the idea of a unified United States of America is falling apart, and different groups are falling into factionalism. Some even say there could be a civil war coming on. But the idea of a unified United States may not be as historical as we think it is. Today's guest is Colin Woodard. He's the author of the new book Union, The Struggle to Forge the Story of the United States. And he looks at the myth of how national unity was created and fought over by five different men: George Bancroft, William Gilmore Sims, Frederick Douglass, Woodrow Wilson, and Frederick Jackson Turner. Most of their names might not be recognizable, but their themes are. George Bancroft wrote in his 10-volume History of the United States, where America was an innocent, unified, God-chosen nation destined to bring liberty to humanity. William Gilmore Sims was an antebellum South man of letters and argued that Bancroft's vision of equality promised by the Declaration of Independence was a sham, and America was built on the superiority of the Anglo-Saxon race, and other races were inferior, and a caste system with slavery was necessary. Frederick Douglass was a famed abolitionist and a fugitive slave, also a huge influence on Abraham Lincoln, who called for America to live up to its promises of liberty for all and that all men were created equal. Woodrow Wilson, the president, was the first Southerner elected to the presidency since the Civil War, a white supremacist who resegregated the government. He screened the movie The Birth of a Nation, a celebration of the KKK at the White House, and his vision of ethno-nationalism persisted until the 1960s. Finally, there's Frederick Jackson Turner, who's famous for his frontier thesis, the idea that America became a free and egalitarian people forged on the frontier. And the idea lives long into the 20th century and explains the popularity for Western movies. So we get into all these different ideas of what American unity means, and for the 21st century, what is a vision that is the best for the future of the nation? This is a very contemporary topic, and there's a lot to unpack here, and I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Colin Woodard. Colin, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, your book is very timely, as a lot of good history is, so I have a lot of questions to ask from you about your book. But first, let's look at the thesis of your book in general before we really get into the particulars. So you argue that in your book, an earlier one, American Nations, that we've never been one America. Could you explain that more?
Yeah, that we've never been one America, but rather several Americas. And the differences all trace back to the distinctions between the different colonial projects that formed on the eastern and southern rims of what's now the United States, that Greater New England and the Dutch-founded area around New York City and the Appalachian backcountry and the Chesapeake Tidewater and the Spanish-settled Southwest and so on, all had different ethnographic and political and religious characteristics. They had different original intents, different societies they were building, different stories of themselves. In other words, they were separate nations, so to speak. They were rivals throughout the colonial period and sometimes enemies, taking the opposite sides of the major conflicts of the colonial era, like the English Civil War. So what they did face was a shared threat by British colonial policy in the 1770s to their respective ways of life and idiosyncrasies and self-government. And they allied together, banded together, and lo and behold, beat the British and found themselves occupying something vague called the United States. And nobody was quite sure what that was. But behind it all, you still had these profound differences between the regions. And each of these colonial projects had and would continue to settle sort of mutually exclusive settlement bands in different tiers of the country, extending generally from their place of origin, extending westward in different tiers. As they did that, they sort of left their assumptions about who we are, where we came from, how society should be organized, the relationship between church and state, between the balancing of individual liberty and the common good. They all had different answers. And those of us who came later, whose ancestors came later, those people assimilated to one of these regional cultures rather than to some greater American culture, because the latter didn't exist. And so that was what confronted people in the early republic when they tried to write a constitution that would somehow each regional culture would be not threatened by the others, because they created federalism and so many checks and balances between chambers and disproportionate representation in the electoral college was all to ensure that one regional culture wouldn't be dominated by the others on the federal stage. But even that still left the country not knowing exactly what the United States was. And Union tells the story of how a story of United States nationhood was created, and a counter story created, in order to fill that terrible vacuum which threatened to leave the country spinning apart.
Right. And that's very interesting, because I think people have a vague understanding of this idea, but not the details. For example, most know with the Civil War that Robert E. Lee fought for the Confederacy. Even if he opposed slavery, he was first and foremost a Virginian, and that was more important in his mind than the idea of a collective United States. So as a thought experiment to get into this before we look at people who promulgated different theses of the United States, let's say we take three Americans. One is from 1790, right after the Revolutionary War. One is from 1870, right after the Civil War. And one is from 1950, right after World War II, where he's basking in the afterglow of victory. If you ask those three Americans, what is the United States, how do you think they would answer that question?
Well, in the 1790s, if you asked them what country they were from, they still would have said, you know, I'm a South Carolinian, I'm a Virginian. And as to what the United States was in 1790, I think a lot of people would have been very unsure, would have had different and opposing answers. You know, is it a European Union-like alliance? Is it NATO? Is it a treaty organization for common defense, right? Or and foreign policy? Or is it a alliance of sovereign nations? Or is it supposed to be or evolve towards being an organic, you know, solid, unified nation of the sort that, say, the Germans were trying to create out of the German Confederacy, out of all those tiny little principalities and grand duchies and such in Central Europe? Nobody knew for sure what answer was the right one, and so there would have been a lot of confusion. I think the best that they could come up with is that Americans were the people who had just fought and been victorious, perhaps against the odds, against Britain to establish their independence and to be self-governing people and to have no aristocracy and no king. And that itself, it was sort of defining itself in the negative about what it wasn't. You know, well, not to jab at Canada, but sort of like Canadians often have to do, you know, we're not the United States in these respects, right? In a sense, that would have been, that same ambiguity would have existed for Americans and for, to some degree, similar to today's Canada, where you have very different regional cultures and histories with Quebec there. It would have been a similar conversation. If you zoomed up to 1870 after the Civil War, well, 1870, you've had the collapse of Reconstruction. So what should have, in quotes, have happened is when Abraham Lincoln had articulated at the Gettysburg Address what this war was about. It was about achieving our ideals that all men are created equal and that they were the last great hope on earth for humans to be self-governing, to show that you can do this and be universally open. That should have won with the war, except it didn't. You know, it's often said that the South lost the war but won the peace. And it was with the collapse of Reconstruction that the North gave up on trying to impose the civic national ideals on the conquered South, and in fact let the South restore order, in quotes, by letting the Ku Klux Klan, you know, continue their reign of terror against African Americans to force them to retreat and give up on holding office and voting in elections and all of those other things. It was a rollback. It was a ceding to the ethno-national vision of the country. And by 1870, because the occupation of the South had been so difficult and the Southerners had resisted it, and Northerners, you know, who probably only had a soft commitment to racial justice to begin with, were so exhausted by the war and its aftermath, people just wanted normalcy. White people wanted normalcy. They wanted normalcy on both sides. And so 1870 would have been about having reconciled white Americans, North and South, blue and gray, having reconciled after a terrible war where both supposedly served with honor, that they had jettisoned the idea of there being a moral content to the war. So if you talk to a white person in 1870, North or South, they would have started speaking in those terms of, you know, shared honor and, you know, the South lost, but together we all fought admirably on the battlefield. And there would have been something like that. And implied in it would have been, you know, without maybe saying it, is that human inequality will be tolerated or embraced, that we're not about those ideals, or if we are, we're certainly not going to be talking about them. So 1870 would be a compromise point where, to reconcile the Civil War, white Americans made those choices. If you talk to a black American, if you talk to Frederick Douglass, he would have, you know, given you a righteous earful about how horrible that compromise was. And he did. You know, you can read speeches and we'll tell you exactly what he thought. If you went forward to 1950, that's an interesting moment because it was in 1910s and 1920s under Woodrow Wilson, the first deep Southern raised president since the Civil War, that the ethno-nationalist white supremacist vision, you know, had its capstone moment, the capturing of the White House and North and South agreeing on and acceding to the resegregation of the federal government and all of these things. But as you move forward after World War I's deployments, and especially after World War II's, where large numbers of African Americans and other non-white people had served in the military, and in places like Hawaii and in England during World War II had discovered environments that weren't as segregated, where there seemed to be a much more openness and less hostility based on race, where they rubbed shoulders with members of British Imperial Forces who were treated much better than Southern officer-led segregated units were in the U.S. Army, that when they went to places like France, that that non-white soldiers were treated with a degree of respect they weren't used to by the civilian population. So people came back having served their country, you know, been injured, risked their lives, and had seen this other environment. And so by the 1950s, all of that, both the World War I and World War II, the legacy of that was happening. So I would call the 1950s, oddly enough, in these terms, were beginning to be a time of turmoil where the civic national ideals and the ethno-national ones were starting to swirl and is setting the stage for the 1960s when the civil rights movement and then a whole slew of other movements for equal rights upended the ethno-national consensus and put the civic national one back in the sort of consensus position for decades.
Okay. And later on in the interview, I want to return to that because I'm wondering a lot with, I think the fears have people now over all the clashes and everything in the protests is that the bedrock of America is cracking. Is that actually true? Or is that just simply the post-World War II institutions that have been around are reforming majorly, and it's not something that's existed for centuries, but more things that we've known for decades. But we'll get back to that. First, I'd like to dive in more deeply into that summation you just gave of where these ideas come from and why they were formed, who formed them, and the power of these narratives. So let's start out with George Bancroft. He's the first to come up with a story of what America is. So when does he come up with this, and what is his story?
Yeah, he comes up with it in the 1830s, and I wanted to tell this story almost in biographical form, like a novel, where you followed the people and you learned the story through the people who articulated and fought in the arguments, because it's the best way to see and understand them, because these intellectual arguments don't just happen as abstractions. They're created by people through their experiences, the childhoods they grew up with, the experiences they had as young people, who their allies were, who their enemies were, and their ideas end up shaping an entire country. But if you want to understand their ideas, understanding the people who came up with them and why is really vital. And in the process, you understand the times and the country at the time by doing that exercise. And George Bancroft is absolutely fascinating in that respect. Not only did he very obviously put and package the civic national vision, but was the first to do it in the 1830s. But he did it through a very unusual set of experiences. So Bancroft's largely forgotten today, but he was the most prominent historian of the 19th century and a prominent statesman who by later in his life was universally respected. I mean, he was the person that Congress chose to give the official eulogy before Congress for Andrew Jackson when he died, for Abraham Lincoln when he died, who was feted and, you know, would host parties at his Washington townhouse for presidents, regardless of party and kings. And he was the one person that the U.S. Senate gave permission to could attend and go on the Senate floor at any time and, you know, sit up at the main podium. I mean, he was a towering statesman-like figure, in part because of his histories. But what he'd started with was a New England upbringing. He was the son of a Congregational minister. He attended Phillips Exeter and Harvard. And then he was sent to Europe as a young man by Harvard's president, Kirkland, who wanted his would-be future professors to earn something new, the doctorate degree, because the only place you could earn a doctorate then was in the universities of Germany, which had created these first real, what we would recognize as research universities. And so he was sent as a 17-year-old to Europe, where he earned his PhD, but he traveled around and sort of like a weird Forrest Gump figure, encountered and hung out with almost everybody, Lord Byron and Washington Irving and Marquis de Lafayette and, you know, Herring, studying literally under Hegel and Herring while they were coming up with the theories of German nationhood and European nationhood. And then he came back to the United States, his head full of these ideas about nations being, you know, organic entities that grow from a seed and, you know, inevitably develop according to the instructions within them, you know, like a plant or something. He molded that with his Puritan New England upbringing that said, you know, we Puritans are, you know, chosen by God, a covenanted people tasked with an errand in the wilderness, you know, put a light on a hill and create a more godly society. He said that Americans were tasked by God to carry human freedom forward for humanity, and, you know, based on the ideals and the Declaration of Independence, and that is our seed, so to speak, that we will grow from, and it's inevitable, and that American exceptionalism and destiny are all rolled up in this. And that's where, you know, he wrote in his histories that, you know, God was sort of present while the founders were writing the Constitution. All of that stuff, that strange mythology around our nationhood, originally gets packaged by Bancroft, and in part because of his own life and background, that it's packaged the way it is.
All right. Well, it sounds like a very optimistic take, and I can see why people embrace it for a very long time. Not the one that others universally accept. There are competing theses on what America is. Tell me about William Gilmore Sims. Sounds like a darker take on it, although in his mind it would not be a darker take, I would imagine. So what is his thesis, and in what context does it find purchase?
Yeah, so Sims is Bancroft's contemporary, and like Bancroft, he's forgotten today, but he was the antebellum South's and the Confederacy's leading man of letters. He was a best-selling novelist, popular in across the United States, and he had a very different set of experiences. He'd grown up in Charleston, and his father had left his mother early on and moved to the wild and frontier, the rough southern frontier in Mississippi and Alabama, had served under a man named Andrew Jackson in the War of 1812. And his mother had been more tied to Charleston and those social circles. And Sims was always torn between the two, but traveled with his father throughout the southern frontier and understood the South in great detail. And his belief was that Jefferson was wrong. The Declaration of Independence was completely and self-evidently wrong, that men and humans are not created equal and don't have inalienable rights, that only certain races, which at a time was a combination of, you know, ethnographies and races, only certain races were capable of self-government and democracy, and that the Anglo-Saxon race, the allegedly superior Anglo-Saxon race, was the one destined to rule here, and that the only one that the Declaration applied to, that we were an ethno-state, the homeland of these Anglo-Saxon race, that the United States was really a federation and alliance of organic nations like South Carolina and Massachusetts, which shared in common this Anglo-Saxon, you know, triumph and legacy. And so that was a very different and contradictory vision of what the United States should be, one that he, of course, embraced, especially once he married well and became a slave plantation owner himself, like he'd always wanted to be. And he carried out this combat with Bancroft and Bancroft's allies, which provided the ammunition that sort of drove us towards the Civil War, the ammunition between these two competing philosophies that would bring the country to brinksmanship.
And this would be found, for example, with those in the Know Nothing Party in Massachusetts that have anti-Irish legislation. Would they be aware of William Gilmore Sims, or is it more of a coincidence that they're pushing forth legislation like this?
I think anyone who was in the reading public at all, who was reading, you know, the speeches, the way that ideas were disseminated and fought over back then were either in speeches or book form, especially speeches because the speeches would be made into books, or newspapers would publish the text of a speech that had just been given, and then other newspapers, as soon as they got a copy, would publish it themselves. They would retweet it, so to speak, and that's how things would spread. And then other people would respond to the speech with their own speech, taking it on. So you'd have this sort of Twitter-like conversation occurring in analog form at a slightly slower pace, but with just as many retweets and replies and arguments. And that was where, you know, it all happened. And anyone who was paying attention to that conversation would have been well aware of Sims and his allies' arguments and points of view. And it, you know, had to either directly or indirectly have shaped some of their own arguments and thoughts as they move forward. Because if the country is only to belong to a subset of its people who are worthy of, you know, practicing democracy, that had all kinds of implications and could be used by all kinds of forces in their local conditions and against people they didn't like in their local environments.
Well, these two ideas will be carried forth in the future, but they're not going to go without modification. But before we jump into the 20th century, we definitely need to look at Frederick Douglass, and his views are heavily contested today. There's last 4th of July, Colin Kaepernick quotes part of one of his speeches, and then others are saying that he's misinterpreting what Frederick Douglass is saying. But let's see what the man himself said. So what did Frederick Douglass say?
Well, he's a pivotal figure in this story of nationhood because, well, you know, Bancroft may have come up with this civic national vision, but because he believed that it was a God had set forth this plan and that it was unfolding according to its instructions, he was very complacent. He didn't believe that anybody needed to push or modify events. Just wait patiently and everything will unfold as it should. And nothing would shake him from this belief, not even the Civil War and the collapse of Reconstruction would shake him from the belief that America was, you know, heading along in its course and don't worry about these things. And he wasn't personally all that interested in the plight of African Americans and others who didn't belong. He ignored Frederick Douglass's existence his entire life, which is a very hard thing to do, particularly when you're ambassador to the United Kingdom at the time that Frederick Douglass is becoming an international celebrity, touring to massive audiences around England, talking about the very themes of your own book, but he just pretended that Douglass didn't exist. But Douglass is important because he took that civic national tradition and said, no, Americans, you have not achieved any of these ideals. You failed in them. You know, my experiences can show it firsthand, and I will describe them to you, that you must finally achieve the ideals that we set out in the Declaration of Independence to achieve, and pointing out the hypocrisies when we did not. And he ended up using his considerable influence and profile and celebrity to not only write speeches and books, but also to go to Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War multiple times to influence him, you know, and pushing him towards decisions like to issue the Gettysburg Address, where he essentially says the purpose of the war is to achieve these yet unachieved ideals in the Declaration of Independence. You know, those were big deal moments. And of course, Lincoln was killed shortly after the war ended, but Frederick Douglass lived in, you know, right in through the late 19th century and, you know, was one of these lone voices on it with a big stage, you know, decrying what was happening during Reconstruction and the rolling back of the sort of winning by the South and by the Confederates of the peace. So he was an enormously important figure, and the speeches he produced talking about America's purpose and story and ideals are some of the best articulations of the civic national vision that we have.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. I recommend for listeners to follow up, read the speech, well, in addition to your book, of course, Frederick Douglass's speech, What to the Slave is the 4th of July, where he expounds that one point he says, what to American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all other days the gross injustice and cruelty to which he's a constant victim. But then he says later that the Constitution is a glorious liberty document and is arguing against secessionists that the ideas of slavery aren't found in the Constitution, but America needs to live up to the ideals. So there's a lot more to get into there. But let's go into later on in the 20th century as these ideas are continually contested. Tell me about the frontier thesis, because I think you can say there's still echoes. I wouldn't say in scholarship, but in a lot of popular history of America, this idea, like Teddy Roosevelt believed it heart and soul, and other people did in the 20th century. So what was the frontier thesis?
Yeah, it had an influence for half a century that was overwhelming and remains with us in popular culture and movies and novels. And it was the argument put forward by a young professor named Frederick Jackson Turner, who had grown up in western Wisconsin and had attended school at the University of Wisconsin in Madison and had a very different regional perspective than many of the other participants in the national conversation who'd been from the older settled East Coast. And his argument was that what made Americans Americans wasn't any of that stuff in the colonial period. Americans became Americans when the settlers crossed the Appalachian Mountains into what's now the Midwest and the West, and separated by geography and everything else from the old world, from the legacy of Europe on the East Coast, essentially separated from history. They had re-entered what Turner imagined to be a sort of Garden of Eden, where they could revert to their true form as good Republicans and freedom-loving individuals, that the experience of the frontier leveled society and stripped away all the, you know, feudal accretions and subtexts of society, and that people were egalitarian and by necessity created self-government and watched out for each other, and that that's what made the American character. And this was, in essence, taking Bancroft's thesis and swapping out God and God tasking things for Darwin. Turner was a child during the Civil War and was at his maturity as a scholar at the turn of the 20th century. And his, in that later age, you know, science and scientific reasoning had become the rage, and in the era of Bancroft, less so. And so he'd argued that Darwinian evolution, environmental adaptation, was what shaped Americans, not God, but rather you arrived in this physical environment and you, like any other organism, adapted to that environment. Now, the problem was that shortly after he issued his essay on the frontier thesis, which kind of went viral, so to speak, and was embraced throughout the country and had a life of its own, and soon everyone was talking about it and was getting inserted into the way universities taught history and into textbooks that three generations of Americans would learn their American history from, and into, you know, films and everything else. But shortly after he issued that thesis, Turner himself, who was a procrastinator as a writer but absolutely loved research, he started diving deeper into his research and realized that that thesis didn't actually work, that the data wasn't showing it. He was getting out, you know, using the new sciences of cartography and federal data collection. He was expecting to see that as settlers crossed over into the Appalachians, into this new environment, that they would become more like each other and all become, you know, freedom-loving egalitarians. And yet, what he found instead is that settlers from the different settlement streams, the ones coming out of, you know, New England and across upstate New York and into the upper Great Lakes states, or the ones coming from Pennsylvania and circulating through the, you know, the upper parts of the lower Great Lakes states, or the Appalachian settlers coming and settling the lower parts of Indiana and Ohio and Illinois and so on, that they actually retained their characteristics and had very distinct behaviors that seemed to persist. He was frustrated by this because he thought it would be environmental determinism, but I guess what he was groping towards, and he spent the last, you know, 2-3 decades of his life trying to write his new magnum opus on America and its sections, it would have been a book that might have been similar to my own American Nations, although I didn't know about his work when I was writing that book back a decade ago. And that that he was frustrated because nobody wanted to hear his new work. It was like being a rock band that had a number one hit smash single, and then you know, when they go on concert tour, nobody wants to hear any stuff from their new album. They just want to hear the old one, right? He couldn't get anyone to pay him more than polite attention to his argument that, no, it's the sections that mattered and have shaped our history. But in a sense, it was too late. His ideas took a life of their own, you know, beyond even what the author of the idea came to think himself.
And as an aside, in Hollywood movies, the most popular genre for probably from World War II up to the 60s and 70s were Westerns. And I was born in the age of Spielberg, and Lucas, but I have a soft spot in my heart for the golden age Hollywood Westerns and those kind of simple themes of man versus nature and other things. A lot of themes don't play as well in the 21st century, but that's another conversation. Do you think a lot of Westerns follow this theme of the frontier thesis and why they were so popular at the time?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of them had some of these ideas, you know, like that there was needed to be a bit of a civilizing force, right? That people came and it was rowdy and perhaps unlawful, and you needed the good people of the sheriff or whoever the hero was to come and sort of guide the town back to safety or guide the town to, you know, more civilized morals or democratic morals. But that basic idea, yeah, that the frontier was making Americans and forging a nation, I think, is in a lot of the Westerns. Even as they're, you know, like Turner himself, ignoring the Native Americans and the fact that this was not an empty Eden, right? There were people there and people who were often the victim of genocide as the expansion happened. Turner just didn't see that at all. Native Americans are almost invisible from his story, just as they're almost invisible from Bancroft's own story. But in the telling of the Westerns and, say, the history that Buffalo Bill put together, another contemporary of Turner's, the sort of aggressor and the victim are reversed. It's always the Native Americans attacking the poor settlers, and then, you know, Buffalo Bill rides to the rescue, or the sheriff, you know, rides to defend the town or whatever it is, when in fact, broadly speaking, the opposite was what was actually happening. So all of those things that are very American were all in those films as well.
All right, well, let's look at the last main figure in your book, Woodrow Wilson, a president that things improved considerably after he had a debilitating stroke. Can't say that about too many presidents, but many would say, and I would agree with Wilson, that's the case. So tell me about him. You're saying that he follows the path of William Gilmore Sims, the idea of Anglo-Saxon race, and there needs to be a caste system based on race. How does Wilson follow this, but then how does he also tweak it for a later period in America?
Woodrow Wilson is a child during the Civil War, and he witnesses Jefferson Davis, after being captured, being marched through his hometown of Augusta, Georgia, to be sent off to trial. And then his family moves to Columbia, South Carolina, where it's a ruin after Sherman has burned it down. And so he's very much a deep Southerner, as his father, like him, was the leading figure in the Confederate Presbyterian Church. Slavery is, of course, gone by then, so it's not about enslavement, but the collapse of Reconstruction in the 1870s had allowed the former Confederate states to reimpose white supremacy backed by both law and vigilante groups. You know, people would be killed if they tried to exercise their rights, or just killed for entertainment sometimes. And he was from a world where that was all the case. And he, in his histories, he basically takes William Gilmore's vision of that ethno-state model, and it's encoded in his own histories, in his own telling of the American story. He writes this book, The History of the American People, where he glorifies the Ku Klux Klan and disparages African Americans as not being capable of self-government or having served in the legislature and the Senate or in Congress. And this becomes really important when he becomes president. You know, many African Americans didn't realize this about him. He had support from some leading African American leaders for his candidacy because they were upset with Teddy Roosevelt's administration and with the way the Republicans had been going. They thought that Woodrow Wilson sounded like he would be giving them a fair deal. Woodrow Wilson said he would give African Americans a fair deal, but in office, he presided over the segregation of the federal government and over the release of Birth of a Nation. So he resegregated the federal government, the government that had won the war, you know, the Civil War, had now been segregated on racial lines. And then he ended up promoting and saving the first Hollywood blockbuster film, The Birth of a Nation, A film which, again, glorified the Ku Klux Klan's reign of terror against African Americans in the South, and a film that had been based on a novel by one of Woodrow Wilson's best buddies and graduate school classmates, Thomas Dixon Jr. And Thomas Dixon Jr. was worried that the film was going to collapse and be a failure and bankrupt him because there were massive protests against the film for its outrageous content. Protests organized often by African Americans in major cities across the country and their allies who were demanding that city and state governments censor the film. And this was at a time when the Supreme Court had yet to rule that artistic products were protected speech under the First Amendment, and cities and states regularly banned theater productions and films that they thought were erode public morals or were not good things for people to see. And there was demand that that happen. If that happened in major cities, this film, which had cost huge amounts of money to create, would have failed. And Woodrow Wilson came to the rescue. He actually screened Birth of a Nation at the White House for his cabinet. And then the next day, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court screened it for the other justices and for the leaders of Congress, because the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court had served in the Ku Klux Klan and thought this was all great. This is a time period when the beginnings of the ethos that would create the 1924 Immigration Act was happening, with its race-based quotas specifically and explicitly designed to keep America, you know, an Anglo-Saxon nation of British and Scots, Irish, and German settlers, and to prevent the contagion of these other races who were not thought ready for democracy. In other words, Woodrow Wilson is the capstone and the triumphant point of the ethno-nationalist cause and definition of American nationhood, one that had broad consensus across both regions among, you know, the white majorities, and allowed this point of view to become dominant for several decades in our history. It's not an obscure or recessive story of nationhood. It's one that had enormous power and was able to capture and control the national zeitgeist for a long period of time, which is why it's, you know, should not be discounted as a minor danger.
Right. So you would say that the Wilsonian view, it's dismantled, as at least as a governing apparatus, with the Civil Rights Act and the civil rights movement in the 1960s. Well, let's talk about modern day implications. And listeners, this is a note to you, especially who've ran out and left 1-star reviews on iTunes because you heard a political view you didn't agree with. Try to keep an open mind and be a good civic nationalist, even if you don't agree with it. So nothing like reading bad reviews on stuff. All right. So in the 21st century, I mean, this episode is being recorded in the wake of June 2020 with the protests against the murder of George Floyd. And there's a lot of discussion, and I would say consternation, on both people on the political left and political right of fear of sort of America breaking up. And if I can do justice to both sides, on the left, the idea is systemic racism has existed in the United States with Donald Trump and other figures. There's a militancy that's trying to revert things to an earlier age, and it fundamentally threatens the American project. People on the right would say that with projects like the 1619 Project in the New York Times, which says the entire basis of the United States is systemic racism, the Revolutionary War was fought to preserve slavery, and this has always existed, almost saying that 1776 was a mistake. And by threatening institutions of free speech and other things and the politicization of different forms of government, this fundamentally threatens the American project. So I suppose, with your take on how there's never been a unified view, is there good news in this, that America lasted when there wasn't a consensus view, so there doesn't need to be some idea of consensus? Or maybe there's a narrative that we can return to, like Frederick Douglass, that is better. So yeah, what's your take on all this?
Well, I think you're right that people are wondering what holds us together as a nation. You know, the red states and blue and MAGA and Black Lives Matter and these fundamental disagreements over values, who's really an American or eligible to be, over monuments and flags and symbols from our past, you know, over the balance between individual liberty and the common good, all kinds of things in recent years. And now these disagreements have spilled onto the streets. And this is definitely a poignant moment. If we look back, how would we hold the United States together? What do we still have that would bring us together that we could agree on? Can we not agree on at least this, right? And the answer to that, I think, is this. The civic national tradition is the one thing in our background that succeeded in holding us together in a way that is defensible in some form and which has broad consensus and could govern a country that is not Anglo-Saxon and Protestant. You know, that's not even a, beyond being an immoral way of looking at things, it's not even practically possible to govern in the ethno-state model. So the one path we have forward as we look to see what we can use to rebond ourselves and refind a shared commitment, a thing that we all agree on, are the elements of the civic national tradition, which is why, you know, I think union is really important, because it gives the background to where this all came from and the ingredients, some of which you would might choose to keep and some you might choose to get rid of as you create an updated and revised story of our purpose and our identity. But you need to draw on what's already there as you build something new, because as people think about belonging, you know, belonging to an abstract thing like a nation, having the legitimacy and the traditions and the longevity of some of these elements is really important to have hope of succeeding in that project. Can one be created? I think it can. Is it inevitable that our country will survive? Absolutely not. You know, this is a real opportunity for us to reinvigorate ourselves, but we need to take it, because if we don't, I think the middle and long-term future for the United States is not a rosy one.
And I mean, something I try to do in the podcast is say that whatever moment we're going through, give context that there's almost nothing that's unprecedented. That's not to say everything will be roses, but with the recent coronavirus, pandemics are not new whatsoever. They are a story older than human history. They are there at the beginning. We've lasted through other pandemics. The situation now, I mean, looking back in the past and thinking of conflicting views of America seeming divided, but then maybe a more optimistic story like civic nationalism versus ethno-nationalism and civic nationalism winning. Are there any moments that stick out in your mind where it seemed like things were going in a bad direction, but then the unifying narrative won out, whether the civil rights movement or other times?
Well, yeah, I mean, in the sort of epilogue to the book, where we carry on after Woodrow Wilson to sort of briefly update what happened thereafter, yeah, that was an enormously powerful moment, because you started with the, you know, sort of white supremacist ethno-national model in the 1920s. And if you fast forward to the 1960s, that's being challenged and overthrown, a resurgence of these, you know, belief that, you know, people should be treated equally, that we're equally human and deserve equal rights, and we're not giving them to, you know, these are not being granted to people, and people aren't able to exercise them, and that must change. That was an enormous development, you know, fueled in part and made possible by the deployments in World War II, like I mentioned, but also the struggle of the Cold War, where the leaders of the country who might have tried to avoid and frustrate this attempt, were realizing that the Soviet Union was able to use in our proxy battles in the Cold War in the developing world, in all these different, you know, battles for hearts and minds, they were able to point to the fact that, you know, non-white people couldn't even, you know, find a hotel room and be discriminated against and couldn't enter restaurants in much of the United States, you know, whereas the Soviet Union would claim that it was, you know, race blind and all that. I mean, the Soviet Union had all kinds of, you know, horrible things about it, but it was able to win a propaganda war. And all of those things created a moment where this change could be made, an enormous overthrowing of that Wilsonian era consensus. So yeah, that was a very bright point. There are other bright points in history that have happened. You know, I was in Eastern Europe in 1989 when communism collapsed, and the sense of hope and possibility, not only among the East Europeans I was living among, but everywhere in the world, across Europe and the West. You know, it almost brings tears to your eyes to remember how that felt when it seemed possible that a better world was going to be built, and how quickly it would collapse in the siege of Sarajevo and the Western reaction to it and all the events that have happened since. So, yes, there are these poignant moments that happen, and, you know, which can give us hope. But also, you know, things often don't turn out very well in the medium or longer term, and we should be, you know, sober and aware of that as well. The Black Death was not a good thing for Europe, even though, you know, Europe carried on later.
Very true, very true. So, well, this is really timely, and there's a lot more to delve into, and I recommend listeners who want to hear a lot more of the story, Look for Colin's new book, Union, The Struggle to Forge the Story of the United States, of United States Nationhood. Colin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
There you have it. That is all for today's episode. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our illustrious Spymasters include Baron Fraser, Chris C., David Santee, Josh from VFW Post 2285, Jake Harrington, Jennifer French Lee, Josh Reddick, Michael from New York, Michael Piccinetti, Nick Brooks, Rob from Chicago, Ryan Gillen, Salvador Sanchez, Tom from Ohio, Moondoggy from Ohio, Bill Ivy, and Wire Meets Wood Guitars at wmwguitars.com. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on Earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.